Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Next guest this morning is the incredible Julie Feeney. She's a singer, she is a songwriter, she's an actor. In fact, there are a few things creatively that Julie hasn't done. After three successful albums and a huge career on stage, Julie took a step off the hamster wheel of production to write her next album, but her plans changed when she had to become a carer for her aging mother. Now, 10 years later, Julie has been named the Dunleary Rathdown Musician in Residence and is moving back into the light of creation and production. Sounds wonderful. Good morning, Julie. How are you?
Good morning, Dermot. How are you?
Can you believe it's been 20 years since your breakthrough album?
Yeah, it's yeah.
13 it was actually, songs?
Yeah, I made it in that year, 2005, and yeah. Won the Choice Music Prize in 2006.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, it is.
Start.
It's an incredible amount of time. Yeah, I don't think you really realize. Yeah, I'm trying to appreciate it a little bit more. Like at that stage when I was doing that, I mean, I had one thing in my mind, which was like the music, you know, like kind of get it moving it on with that. And well, although I'd been a composer for dance before that, and I'd all, you know, obviously was a professional choral singer and doing all that. But it's, you know, you're going along and you're that's your route and your plan. And I think I remember saying I'd have like five albums, but I've, you know, I've three, and I've nearly an opera and two and three other projects as well that are in development. But yeah, like
Let's longer give people, than I yeah. give people a little flavour of it in case they need to be reminded of it, of 13 songs. Do you hear you in that, or do you hear an older version of you or a different you when you listen back to that voice?
I don't think anyone is comfortable listening to themselves sing. I don't know. I'm like, what is that? I can't really listen to myself, to be honest. I can sort of watch myself when I'm playing a different character, if it's an acting thing.
Yeah.
But I can't, because that seems like it's somebody else. But even though I'm very meticulous about, I listen back to everything, but I record everything and I analyse it. But that's more as the producer head sort of, you know, cutting it down to and making it into something. But then I just don't listen to it as me at all.
No, interesting, isn't it? No. I think everybody has that. I remember hearing somewhere, I don't know how scientifically correct this is, but that because we listen to ourselves in our own head, so to speak,
yep,
the acoustics of our skull is different, so that we may hear a tone to our voice that people outside of our heads don't hear. And that's why it can seem a little bit jarring when we listen back to ourselves.
Yeah, I think I was a professional choral singer for about 10 years as well. So you get very attuned to that kind of thing, because you have to then adapt to everything around you and the sounds around you and trying to be in tune with everybody else. So this was Chamber Choir Ireland that I was in. So that's, yeah, so you do get, but then it's to achieve a purpose. You are making the piece of music as opposed to it being you, the person, you know.
Yeah.
You're still being the artist or singer making the actual piece of work. So
yeah.
You have that kind of purpose. So it's kind of okay to do, you know, but in terms of if it's yourself, you'd want to lie down on a sofa and stretch out and sort of, that's a whole different thing.
You found yourself in Riverdance at one point.
Yeah, I toured with Riverdance, and I did, which was an amazing experience. I knew at the time that there were three huge big shows out of Ireland, and I knew that it was kind of something I wanted to try and do. So I was part of all three of them. that was brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant scores, you know, Bill's score is just magnificent still. It's just such a classic. And yeah, it was an amazing experience.
What parts were you singing? In what ways were you across the show?
Well, that was quite at the start. So I was singing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was one of the one of the choir. So I toured in America.
Yeah.
Toured all over America.
Powerful experience in those early days.
Incredible to be part of that. Well, no, I wasn't part of it in the early part. I was still in, you know, in college and school or whatever then at that stage. But to be part of that huge production, it was an amazing opportunity for all the Irish performers and musicians, singers, dancers, everything. It's an incredible, you know. That was incredible.
You had to take a step back from music to care for your mum. What was your mum's name?
Teresa.
Teresa. And where did you grow up?
Galway. So, well, actually, Mary Teresa Murphy.
Okay.
Was her maiden name, and then Teresa was her name, or Mrs. Feeney, because she was a principal teacher for 45 years in Abenachboy. And
yeah.
So I don't think you sort of decide to take a step back. I don't, like, sometimes in your life you think you have a plan, but then it just kind of takes a corner, you know. So I won't talk too much about them, but I have two smallies as well, two little people.
Yeah.
Which I adore and love. They're just like anybody does. But you can still kind of, you can fire a child in the back of a car and you can actually go somewhere and you can perform or work. You can work around it. It, you know, it won't be ideal.
Yes.
But I haven't ever really done that really at all. But it would be possible if you had to, you know.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
When I think when I became full-time carer, initially I was managing everything with sibling for like 3 years. So I was spending, you know, half the week in Galway and then I'd be up the other half the week trying to juggle the little one, you know, and all of that. So it was really tough going up and down, because you can see when somebody is beginning to, when they're beginning to live with dementia, when you can start the early start of it, Alzheimer's in her case, you want to be there as a support. And my main goal was to try and preserve her quality of life for as long as possible, you know. And then ended up for five years, being her full-time carer. So she was with me. So she had my room, and I just, you know, gave her all that. And like, it didn't feel like, I never really consciously decided to do that. I mean, my fourth album, I know I've now 10 songs done, but that's like, that was, you know, 10 years ago.
Do you know what? I think a lot of people can relate to what you're saying in terms of, you didn't plan. You didn't wake up one morning and write on your to-do list, I'm going to be a carer now.
Never.
It's the
in my
nature,
dreams.
I think, of what they call the sandwich generation, of where you've got kids, but now you find yourself having a more responsible role with elderly parents, and then illness knocks on the door and things get a little bit more complicated. And I think it's always a fluid situation that you just have to adapt to, and the dynamics change all the time.
Yeah, that's true. It is definitely true. At the same time, for me, even though, like, I remember I saw that Sharon Horgan, one of her brilliant TV shows, there's a scene where the brother says to the sister, you got off the hook because you've got two kids, so you're not going to have to do the job, you know. And I was thinking, wow, I'm the opposite of that. I have two smallies. But it didn't feel like, I know it's the sandwich generation, but I just sort of felt more like a unit. It just felt like the natural thing to do. And I actually think that, you know, older people, if you're in your 70s or 80s and you're being a carer, I know it was crazily difficult for me with, you know, on my own with two little children and my mum. But for somebody who's actually their 70s or 80s, I think that's really, really difficult for like a couple, you know, because everybody assumes like for 50 years they've been together. And I think that's really tough, you know, for those people, because obviously they're older. Like, you know, I'm youngish person. I was young, you know, younger doing it, so at least I was okay. But literally, because it's a physical job as well, you know, it's a very physical job. It's all encompassing. And
my own mother had dementia, and it was a strange experience because obviously it's a difficult one. I wonder, did you find that you think that the worst moment in the world would be when my parent doesn't recognize me? You think that's going to be just the worst. Now, it's not pleasant by any means. But actually, I found that wasn't the worst thing, because it's so gradual, it's kind of happening.
Yeah.
I found the helplessness about her anxiety, that she just seemed so worried, and I couldn't get through to her. What were the pieces of it that you found most challenging?
Well, I found, for me also, the not remembering. I mean, I remember the first time that happened, and it was a bit of a blow. But then I realised I actually didn't care about that. I wasn't concerned in any way, and she didn't disappear for me really at all. And I know she does for a lot of people, and they find that. For me, she didn't disappear. She was the same person. I just saw the more beautiful sides to her. I saw the quirkier sides. I didn't realise she was as quirky. I knew she was always hilariously funny.
Yeah.
But she had to hold her station so well in her life as a principal teacher, and she'd six of us through college and everything. She, you know, she I got to see that beautiful side. So I think that for me, I was very interested in the sensory world. Like I found that even though, like she, you know, one time somebody said, she'd always say right to the very end, Julie, where's Julie? Where's Julie? Where's Julie? You know, and somebody said, and who's Julie? And she went, me sister, me pal, me child. You know, like it was kind of like one, you know, and I thought that was, like kind of, it didn't matter. She just, it was just like that, the person, you know what I mean? Yeah. The person that she was with. And I think, I mean, exactly as you say, the most rewarding part for me was to try and reassure her. Because like, if you're with somebody every night for that length of time, the last like 5 months or so, she was in and out of, you know, various hospitals and things like that, just for the last 5 months. But, and I was still in with her every day. But she, like, it's reassuring her. And I found the senses, the sensory world was what really opened up for me. I'm very interested in that anyway, in a lot of the case as an artist. But like, I found that the lighting, I went really into the finding the right lights, finding the right music, the timing of things, like tone of voice, and just the two little children, she loved them as well. And the little one, she was only one and she was only two. And she actually, that was a great thing for her. So the most difficult thing is, I suppose, well, we were in a bubble and we also went through the pandemic. And so, like, you know, my brother dropped in shopping to us every week. But, you know, the way it was, nobody, you couldn't have anybody. So you're completely on your own. And you're doing things like, I was doing a very important meeting on a panel for something, you know, because I obviously still an artist trying to keep your hand in at it, you know. So I did a lot of writing. But you're out, you know, you're in on this call and there's like, there's a whole lot going on behind you, and you're, every time there's a break, you're running out to remedy things. So I think what's the difficult thing is, I think it's more difficult for me that she's gone, to be honest, than kind of to see her, because I know it's a very difficult and very challenging for people when they say that the person isn't there anymore. I completely understand how they say that. For me, I just found just such a beauty. The beauty inside her, I learned so much from her, and she taught me so much too. Like, she, it's about patience. You know, the way that I became patient. I don't think I was patient before. You just, your patience, whatever about patience being challenged as a parent, I just found, as being a carer, your patience is just like, you just have to leave it out. Just leave it all flat. Just, You have to become, I know you're an expert in all the other kind of stuff like mindfulness and all that, but you have to become, you know, kind of zen about it. And then, of course, you have to maintain your own self-worth as well, which is the whole other side of it, you know.
Yeah, I remember after I visited my mum, because it was emotionally tough, I used to go and have like a power cry in the car afterwards, just to sort of release that's built up. There's everything going on. There's frustration, there's sadness, there's confusion, you know, and I just found that a little sort of steering wheel cry for about 30 seconds would sort of allow me to move on.
Apparently it's 90 seconds.
Really?
Yeah, apparently it's 90 seconds. And that's one of the things with grief that I've tried to do is like when you're so afraid to go there because it's so horrible. Physiologically, now I know the experts out there can tell me, but I kind of tried it out. And actually, if you let it out for the night, it's 90 seconds and then it's kind of, you know, it's like a reset or something. I mean, I'm fascinated by the whole world, but that is really, it was definitely a thing. And it was great, exactly as you said.
But let you do have, you do have these strange moments of sort of beauty in there, don't you?
Like, oh my God.
Because my mum grew up in Rossmuck in Connemara. So her Irish started to come back to her.
Oh my goodness, you're from.
And she's, her love of traditional Irish music came back to her. So she loved going to a pub and hearing live trad music, and it just so lifted her. But she always was a very sort of plain eater, never watched sports, didn't drink beer. But there was one stage where she used to watch rugby with me and drink beer and eat spicy chicken wings, and we'd have the best time. It was just this sort of interesting period in the... you know, throughout the dementia, where that was just a little window. And those little moments can be really precious, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I was very, very careful in it. And I wanted to be, with some of those moments, that I wasn't going to be feel like those moments in a patronising kind of way. Do you know what I'm saying? I found that I kind of was, I'd kind of analyze them first and kind of see. So there was a couple of unfiltered, many unfiltered experiences that we did have. But I found like, yeah, the, I mean, obviously this being straight up about things, I mean, I won't say some things that were like brilliant because I wouldn't like, you know, I don't want to, that was her, it was between me and her in a way and it was a beautiful time. But like things like, yeah, as you say, I mean, she did always like theatre and music and art. Like I did bring her to the Lexicon, for example, those beautiful dementia friendly tours of art. I brought her into the Gate as well. And I remember Vincent who announces, you know, when the shows are on, he was really, really patient. We had to leave at the last time I brought her was we had to leave at half time. You know what I mean? I think those moments, yeah, we pushed
them.
Remember
like, you remember the moments of kindness of strangers as well, don't you?
Oh, my goodness.
Because you can be out socially and it's a difficult scenario because you're trying to give normality to something that's not normal. And sometimes if someone, like you said, someone shows patience or kindness or understanding, they really stick out in your memory.
I remember I was down on a street and I was trying to manage the two of them on their own, which was really rewarding for the little ones as well. Obviously, I know it sounds a bit hardcore to like kind of, you know, a bit of an intense situation, but I was down on the street and it was mayhem. I mean, it was, there was people trying to get out of the car and get into the car and go over here and go over there. You know, I was trying to manage them all. And this woman just appeared. She was about, I'd say 70. She'd grey hair, just appeared outside the window and she just went, "It's going to be okay." Just her window, her face just appeared like a ghost completely outside the window. And I went, "Thanks, thanks," you know. Yeah. And I've never seen her again or, you know, but she just, so you do remember those moments.
Well, talk to me, Julie, about your residency, because I guess one of the opportunities, having gone through what you did with your mum, is you'll be able to take those experiences and bring them to your art now, I would guess.
Yeah, I have an awful lot of, I have a huge amount written, and because the nature of being, even if we had people coming in during the day during the day to help you, were always down to an absolute time. It would be only X amount of time. So everything was just so scheduled, like there was no breaks or holidays or anything like that. But I did write a lot and I used my voice memos an awful lot. I really leaned into that a lot.
Yeah.
So I did. I was so lucky to have had, I had awards that, so I ended up, I have 50,000 words written all around this on one project, and I have another project that's in development from then. So I'm kind of like, I'm a bit stagnated the projects that I have because I couldn't fully develop them at that time. So I've come out and now I've started to put them into development. So I was with an actor and a choreographer recently, another director. You know, I'm kind of piecing together now all the stuff that I did have.
Are you excited to see where your art is now at this time after the break and see where performance takes you and where the life experience brings you with your art?
Oh my goodness. I feel like I didn't know anything back then. I mean, I don't know how many interviews I did, you know, millions of interviews, and not millions, but and I don't know what I was talking about because, like, I feel like I knew nothing. Like, I'm kind of going, "What are you talking about?" Because I just feel now like a lot of it is, you know, just not nonsense. I mean, it's all important, but I think that definitely it's really made me reassess my values. What are your values in life? And
what do you think your values are now?
Oh gosh, I mean, for anybody's values, like these days, it's really hard with obviously we don't have the state of the world. I think the fundamental thing is, you know, that sets of people, one set of people believes that they're superior to another set of people. You know, if you think so many things in the world kind of come back to that, and we're seeing it more and more and more, it's kind of increasing how people are, you know, whether it's in Gaza or people being, you know, murdered and every day. I think my values, I'm quite, I think it's very much about, I hate to say kindness, you know, but we have to take stock of where we are, and we can't. It's just kind of gone a little bit out of hand in relation to that. We have to come.
I
right
wouldn't
back
hate to say kindness at all. I think the world needs it now more than ever. You know.
Yeah, but it kind of, the word kind of became a little bit sort of cliched or something for a while. I just think on every level, even with say dementia, you know, I found that, I think that's one of the things I learned, that for some reason somebody with dementia is not as valid as a person who doesn't have dementia. You know, people sometimes talk about them like as if they're still not real people, or and you know, little comments or whatever. And it's very on very subtle levels that you kind of see that, and that really bothered me. And it still kind of does bother me about that. So,
but like you say, it makes those little moments of kindness stand out when you do meet them, like that lady who came up and told you everything was going to be okay, you know, a little oasis of kindness. Where can people experience your work now that you've been named the Dunleary Rathdown Musician in Residence? What does that mean for your audiences, and where are they going to get to experience what you're doing, all the many things?
I'm doing workshops in the Lexicon around breathing. It's like Breathing Dunleary with Julie Feeney.
Fantastic.
And so three of them they'll have to apply for, and then the other one will be kind of more open for a kind of a general one. And then I am going to create a piece, and it's going to be performed in November in the studio there. This is the start of the residencies from May to November, so I have an awful lot of work to do. Thankfully, I have my album half recorded, so that's because then hopefully the other things will be coming out like next year or, you know, moving along more next year.
Is there a website or social media, or do you do all that?
I get allergic to social media. I just can't.
You're not the only one.
I cannot do it sometimes. I mean, but I obviously have to, but there will be Dunleary Rathdown, and the Lexicon will
Lexicon.
Have all
okay,
that.
We've got people to contact and check out the Lexicon. Julie, thank you so much for coming in to chat to us. I think I can see by the messages we'll get to in just a couple of minutes that it really resonated with a lot of people. I wish you the best. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to hear the many layers that your art will bring, and I hope that people get to see you perform. We'll give people one more of your tracks, Impossibly Beautiful. I think a lot of people will know this, and it is Impossibly Beautiful. Julie Feeney, thanks so much for chatting to us this morning.
Thank you. I knew not your heart.